It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today on the program, we explore controversies involving the separation of church and state, not only in our state, Iowa, but also in national news. And as we've been covering the news, both in the state and nationally, you've certainly heard about some of these cases that we want to talk about. For instance, last month, the U.S. Supreme Court narrowly upholding a centuries-old tradition of offering prayers to open government meetings, even if prayers are overwhelmingly Christian and citizens are encouraged to participate. Also, the so-called Hobby Lobby case before the Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court, we're waiting for a decision there, determining whether the Free Exercise Clause of the U.S. Constitution and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act can exempt a company from federal government regulations requiring employees to provide contraceptive coverage to female employees. Then, as we focus in on Iowa news, perhaps you've heard of Governor Branstad recently stirring some controversy by declaring July 14th to be a day of prayer in accordance with a biblical verse. Also, in Cedar Rapids, an image of Jesus on a Cedar Rapids fire truck has led to an investigation. We'll tell you a little bit about that. Also, should Linn County employees be able to take paid time off to attend a lecture during the workday on Muslim history in Iowa at a mosque? Some of the stories will be looking at this issue through the lens of stories in our news. And starting us off, two political scientists with us. Dennis Goldford is with us, professor of politics at Drake University, part of our regular Wednesday politics crew. But it is not Wednesday. It's Monday, and we're glad to have Dennis Goldford with us. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Ben.
Dennis is author of The Constitution of Religious Freedom, God, Politics, and the First Amendment. Also joining us, Scott Peters in our Iowa City studio. He's Associate Press Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. He also teaches constitutional law, civil rights, and liberties at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
Dennis, let me start off with you. You teach constitutional law at Drake, church and state, this phrase thrown around a lot in conversation in our news. Take us back to the origins of it. What is meant by that?
Well, you know, phrases like separation of church and state are used quite often. And it's sometimes at this point, I think, it doesn't clarify as much as it obscures. But the basic idea is that the church, on the one hand, should not be an arm of the state. That is, the government should not use the state, the church, or any particular religion for its own political purposes. But also at the same time, that the state should not be an arm of the church or religion. No particular religion or church should be able to use the state, the political and coercive power of the state and government, for its own particular religious or theological purposes. So that's very abstract and it's very general, but that's the umbrella under which all these particular issues arise.
Mm-hmm. So we see there, you said very general, so there is obviously some intersection where we have religion intersecting with government. Is it clear where that line is?
Well, that's what makes for constitutional law and constitutional controversies because, for example, it's pretty clear that the Establishment Clause – and again, we know that the first part of the First Amendment deals with religion. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And at least since the 14th Amendment was enacted and ratified, the assumption is that it means any level of government, not just Congress. But it's the idea that an establishment is, as I said, you cannot require people to affirm a set of particular religious beliefs to be a citizen of the United States. And the Free Exercise Clause suggests you cannot require people to deny or reject a set of religious beliefs to be a citizen of the United States. But it gets tricky in the details. So most people would agree that you cannot use taxpayer funds to buy theology textbooks for a parochial school. But can you provide funds that you would provide to the parents of any student for bus transportation to a parochial school in addition to a public school? And long ago, the court said, yes, you could do that.
Okay. We want to reach out to our listeners this hour and ask you, River to River listeners, how do you understand the separation of church and state? Is there perhaps a case in your community involving the separation of church and state that has caused some controversy? Already on our Facebook page, you can go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Tony has posted, I do not feel the public funds should be used for any project that promotes religion. We'll talk about a Christian park being built in Sioux City in just a few moments, but also join us by our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, as I just mentioned, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Scott Peters, you teach constitutional law and other things at the University of Northern Iowa, and I understand that the Hobby Lobby case, we're waiting a decision on that, involves this very question, and you're using it in the classroom. Remind us again, what is the Hobby Lobby case involve? What is the question before the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, as most people know it, required that preventative care be paid for. And in order to enact that law, the Department of Health and Human Services had to write a certain number of regulations to define what preventative care is. One of the things that Congress decided was that preventative care needs to make sure to take care of women's health. And the Department of Health and Human Services decided that in order to protect women's health and provide health services on equal par for women that we do for men, that employers should be required when they provide a health insurance plan to their employees, they should be required to provide contraception.
Mm-hmm. So what is each side arguing here?
In that case, what's happening is that Hobby Lobby, which is a large nationwide employer that most people are probably familiar with, Hobby Lobby is claiming that they are sort of founded by and operate under certain religious principles, and that their religious principles prevent them from paying for and providing that kind of contraceptive care to their employees, and that the government enforcing them to do so is interfering with their free exercise of religion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the other side of the case is?
Side of the case is the government, which says essentially, look, we have to be able to pass laws that everyone needs to be able to follow. You are a business. You're not a church. The government, in fact, did exempt churches and religious nonprofit institutions from this requirement. But they decided that's where they would draw the line, that if you're a for-profit business, you're different, you're putting yourself out in the marketplace, and you're subjecting yourself to the same kinds of regulations that other businesses in the marketplace subject themselves to.
Mm-hmm. Knowing the Roberts Court, what would you say is happening? What are what's the likely breakdown in the vote here?
Well, as with a lot of these close cases, it seems like Justice Kennedy may be the deciding vote. Based on the questions that were asked in oral arguments, it certainly seems like there are four pretty clear votes in favor of Hobby Lobby and four pretty clear votes for the government, and it kind of hinges on Justice Kennedy. There seem to be ways that he could kind of slice and dice it to avoid a clear ruling one way or the other. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of hard to read based on the oral arguments. I do think it's a very significant case that could have huge ramifications down the line, though. It's probably the most significant case the court's considering.
I want to get Dennis's view on this. But first of all, Scott Peters, what are the ramifications you see depending on the decision?
If we just look at the Health Care Act itself and we don't look at anything else, if Hobby Lobby wins, what if I'm a Christian Science employer and I don't want to provide certain types of health care to my my employees? What if I'm
a little background. Christian Science beliefs would prevent a lot of what we call sort of conventional health care, right?
Right. A lot of modern medicine. What if I'm an employer who has some other kind of religious objections to particular types of health care? And then you can extend that beyond simply the health care situation. And can you imagine different types of government regulatory schemes that might in some way interfere with a business where the business owner could say, well, you're impeding on my religious rights as a business owner now?
Mm-hmm. Dennis Goldford, what do you see the impact of this decision, which I guess is due before the end of the month?
Usually they try to wrap up by early to mid-June if possible. But I think Scott's right that this is a huge case. What's interesting, of course, will be to see what, as usual, Justice Scalia does, not just Justice Kennedy, because 24 years ago in the case of Employment Division versus Smith, Justice Scalia authored an opinion that said – and it worried people on the religious right and the religious left both – he said that government can pass any kind of generally applicable law that is not aimed at or targeting any particular religious group. And if that's the case, then there's no religious objection or exemption based upon the First Amendment to such a law. And everybody said there goes any kind of protection for the free exercise of religion and religious belief. So that kind of language, of course, upset a lot of people, which is what led to what's called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is part of what's at issue in this particular case. But yeah, this has tremendous import. And you know, as usual, it's not really so much the case that in these sorts of controversies it's sort of atheists versus religious people. It's people of one religious tradition against people of another religious tradition. And so as indeed was suggested, you've got a problem, say, perhaps with Christian Scientists if they say we won't pay for health care, period. Or if you've got, say, a Jewish or a Muslim employer that says we won't pay for healthcare-related issues arising out of the fact that you eat pork. So to what extent, if you're going to work for someone who is not a church or religious body itself, to what extent are you as an employee subject to the religious values and beliefs of your employer? That's really what this is about.
Join our conversation as we talk this hour about the separation of church and state as it's found in specific news cases at a nationwide level here, the Supreme Court decision due before the end of the month. Also here in Iowa, join us 1-866-780-9100. Is there a case in your community involving the separation of church and state that's caused some controversy? 1-866-780-9100. Also, you can go to our Facebook page, and a review is taking place in regards to a public grant awarded to a Christian park here in Iowa. Nonprofit Shepherd's Garden plans to build a park in Sioux City as a place for people to reflect and have a spiritual respite. The park brochure says, in response to the rise of secular influence in our culture, Shepherd's Garden seeks to create a permanent Christian green space for the community that promotes visible reminders of Christian values and symbols. However, now the Iowa Economic Development Authority will meet on June 11th to consider pulling the $140,000 it planned to go toward that group. The grant faces opposition from people who say it violates separation of church and state. Scott, what is your view on that case?
Well, one of the most fundamental reasons for the Establishment Clause was to try to make sure that the government would not give money to support religion. There's very little doubt of that historically. That's one of the reasons for it. Now, for that reason, even today, even among Supreme Court justices who are very sympathetic to the accommodation of religion in public life, the justices tend to be more skeptical when federal funds flow directly into a religious institution or a religious organization. That said, there's another side of the coin here, and that's that if you've set up a public program where anybody can apply for funds, if you discriminate against a particular group because they're religious, you could actually run into problems with the free exercise clause.
Can you discriminate based on any religion? Just say if it has any religious affiliation, then that's not good for the output of public money.
Even that could be problematic because the free exercise clause not only protects you from being discriminated against based on what particular denomination you are, but it also protects you being discriminated against because you are religious or non-religious. And so this illustrates how the two clauses in the Constitution that protect religious freedom don't always necessarily play nicely with one another. I mean, sometimes they do come into conflict. And in this case, if the government specifically exempts particular religious groups, then they could face the challenge that if they exclude religious groups, they could face the challenge that they're discriminating based on viewpoint under free speech, or that they're discriminating based on exercise of religion in some way.
Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. How do you understand the separation of church and state? Joining us also, Chuck Hurley is with us in our Des Moines studio, president of the Family Policy Center, also former president of the Family Leader. Chuck Hurley, welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to our conversation here about the origins of this phrase, church and state. What is your view, your position on this, and interpreted through the news events that are with us every day?
Ben, I'm a little bit in awe and a little intimidated being here with Dennis Goldford. He's written a book on it. I love this topic. I did my doctoral thesis, so to speak, in law school on the religion clauses, and have had about 60 cases or controversies as an attorney regarding this field, and I just love it. So thanks for having me. I would like to stay here all day and into tomorrow.
Well, we've got just under 40 minutes left, so have at it.
So just to make a few maybe more soundbite points, this is an extremely important area of the law because of a number of reasons. One is our nation was literally founded by people seeking religious liberty. I mean, most of the people who endured the hardships of those very, very difficult and deadly trips from Europe were seeking asylum from some very oppressive rulers. I mean, the Huguenots and the Quakers were being slaughtered and the Pilgrims were being pursued from England. And so, my goodness, religious liberty is so dear and near to the foundation of our country, and frankly, I think to every human being on the planet. We want to be able to think and believe and act according to the dictates of our deepest conscience.
Okay, but when it involves the government, where do you draw the line? There is undoubtedly some intersection, but when are our rights violated?
Well, I'm probably going to cause heart failure on the part of some religious right-wingers that are listening right now. But I would always lean toward more freedom and less government involvement and coercion. I think the real danger historically was when Theodosius, emperor, in 390 AD, when he made Christianity the official religion. And for the next 12 centuries, there were horrible atrocities by the state trying to enforce belief. And so I'm hopefully always going to come down on the side of less government dictate, intrusion, coercion. I think where it gets hard is our founders also were extremely religious people. They most of them were deeply Christian in their theology, and they believed that Christianity was superior. I mean, it sounds kind of dogmatic now. It sounds kind of, you know, I don't know, religiously jingoistic. But I mean, the Mayflower Compact said that the purpose of them coming to these shores was to advance the Christian religion. So
you're saying in the question of is this a Christian nation, you would be saying yes, not a secular nation formed by Christians.
I've read the Treaty of Tripoli, and I know that, you know, there's a dispute over why that was put in there. Was it for political reasons? Probably. But I would say that our founders, because of their deep faith in Jesus Christ, accorded the most religious liberty of anybody to Jewish people, to atheists, and so forth. So I would say that our country is founded on the premise of freedom, religious freedom, but it was founded primarily by fundamentalist Christians. And so I don't think they were dogmatic. In fact, they wrote the First Amendment because there was a lot of sparring in the various states that had established religions at the state level. And they really were amazingly, I think, even divinely inspired to come together and reduce that acrimony, come together as a body politic, form a very loose federal government, and respect each other's consciences. I think that's the core issue here. Do we respect people's deepest held beliefs, or don't we?
Chuck Hurley, president of the Family Policy Center, in our conversation. Let's also introduce Robert Cargill back to our program, assistant professor of religious studies and classics at the University of Iowa. He specializes in the study and research of Judaism and early Christianity. He's in the religious studies department at the University of Iowa. Bob, welcome back to our program.
Good to be back.
We've got a few minutes before we go to break. You've been listening to what everybody has been stating initially. We want to talk about some of these cases in more detail, also get to callers and emails that we have here. Throw out some of your perceptions, your ideas, as you do, coming from a deep study of the Bible and Christianity.
I think there is no doubt whatsoever that the founders of our nation were theistic. That is, they believed in a God. Now, beyond that, there was obviously debate over not necessarily which religion. I think for the most part, most of them were Christian. This is back when, you know, Unitarians and Universalists were considered Christian. Not that they are not today, but there's some question about that, and we'll set that aside. There's no doubt that they were theistic, but when you read, for instance, the Constitution, not the things that brought them there, but when they sat down and said, how are we actually going to govern ourselves? When we read the Declaration of Independence, when we read the Constitution, had they wanted to establish a Christian nation, they would have done so. There would have been a mention of Jesus. There would have been a mention of Christianity, but there is not. There are generic mentions of a creator or of nature's God, and these at best can be considered deistic ideas. That is, there's no doubt that they were theistic. Now, not all of the founders were Christian. Some of them disliked religion. Some of them understood the problems between denominations. And so what they decided to do, and I think a very wise act, is to say, let's acknowledge that there is a creator or that there is some kind of natural law, and then let's leave out any mention of Christianity. And that's what they did. There is no mention of Jesus, no mention of Christianity in the Declaration of Independence, in the Constitution. And they did that deliberately.
Mm-hmm. Dennis Goldford, do you agree with that assessment?
I think so. In fact, at the time of the ratification debates, there were quite a number of Protestant ministers who opposed the adoption of the Constitution precisely because it had no mention of Jesus Christ or Christianity or things like that. I think, in fact, they were well aware of, and you can see this even in Madison in the Federalist Papers, of the potential for strife caused by religious conflict. They were looking for ways of avoiding this sort of strife. And their argument, I think, was essentially to make religion a matter of individual conscience, individual free exercise of religion, and make sure the state took what economists would call a kind of laissez-faire attitude toward religion.
Okay, we have to take a break. Dennis Goldford with us, Scott Peters, Bob Cargill, Chuck Hurley, talking about the separation of church and state in various cases, how that's interpreted. We'd like to have you join our conversation. When we come back, I want to put this case to our panel here. In April, Governor Branstad signed a proclamation inviting all Iowans who choose to join in the thoughtful prayer and humble repentance according to a verse in Chronicles, a day of prayer. That's to be July 14th. Is this overstepping the mark? There's some controversy about that. We'd like your view, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support comes.
I'm Ben Kiefer. Today on River to River, we're exploring controversies involving the separation of church and state in Iowa and national news. With us, Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University, author of The Constitution of Religious Freedom, God, Politics, and the First Amendment. Scott Peters is with us as well from the University of Northern Iowa, where he's also in political science. And Robert Cargill, assistant professor of religious studies and classics at the Religious Studies Department at the University of Iowa. Chuck Hurley, president of the Family Policy Center, chewing over some of these cases in the news on a national level, also on a state level, wanting you to join our conversation. How do you understand the separation of church and state? Is there a case in your community involving the separation of church and state that has caused controversy? Before we go back to our conversation with our guests, let me read a couple of emails. Peter in Iowa City says, there is no way the government can serve all the people of if it is in any way entangled with religion, because religion is intrinsically divisive. The very first tenet of any religion is we are the elect, we are the only ones with the right answers. Policies favoring any religion automatically disadvantage atheists, writes Peter in an email. And we have Mary saying, while these cases cause controversy, she points out that the separation of church and state can be a way to keep the peace. She brings up a comparison to religious conflict and violence in India between the Hindus and the Muslims. Also, a Facebook post from Ariane, if a pagan Buddhist or Muslim group tried to get public funds to build a green space with their religion as a theme, would it be granted? If not, a Christian group shouldn't get funds either. Ariane referencing a park that's underway being built in Sioux City. A review is taking place in regards to the public a grant awarded to this Christian park. So let's talk a little bit about Governor Branstad's action back in April. He signed a proclamation inviting all Iowans who choose to join in the thoughtful prayer and humble repentance according to a verse in Chronicles in the Bible. And July 14th is the day that according to that proclamation, a day of prayer. Should the governor of Iowa invite Iowans to pray in this official, in his official capacity, a specific prayer out of Christianity? Chuck Hurley.
You know, I just read last night most of the 80-page opinion that's the most recent Supreme Court ruling, City of Greece, New York, on public prayer before a council meeting. And I think the heart of that ruling was, and I'm not saying I agree totally with the ruling, but I think the heart of the ruling was that tradition matters to an originalist. In other words, what did our founders, who literally wrote the First Amendment, sent it through Congress and then sent it to the states for ratification, what did they think? Why, you know, as they wrote it, what was permissible, what wasn't? And clearly during that time of our history, governors like John Hancock and, and presidents like Washington and others did these type of proclamations all the time. So I think
– but I mean by that reasoning, slavery was also legal at that time, wasn't
it? Let me finish. But so by analogy to the City of Greece case, the First Amendment certainly would allow these type of proclamations. I'm just saying by analogy, the latest Supreme Court ruling, though it was 5-4. So the members of the dissent, Justice Kagan in particular, might come down with a different opinion on Governor Branstad's proclamation. Now, apart from current Supreme Court jurisprudence, this gets really, really interesting. It gets more interesting, I think. So I don't think it's merely a legal issue. Mm-hmm. I think at the heart of the proclamation is a recognition by the governor, at the heart of Hancock's and Washington's, and by the way, Abraham Lincoln's proclamations urging prayer and repentance, was a recognition that we're in trouble, folks, and we need to cry out to a power way higher than us. And so that's a very specific belief system. That does fly in the face of an atheist, and depending on the language of the proclamation, it might fly in the face of a Unitarian or somebody else. So bottom line, I'm wrapping up here, 10, 20 more seconds. So bottom line is, somebody, in this case the governor, in Washington's case President George Washington, believes in a higher power and urges people to cry out to him. But there's no coercion. That's what the establishment of religion is all about.
And also the official website of the governor says the issuance of a proclamation does not constitute an endorsement by the governor. And also one day after signing this proclamation, he invited Iowans to pray in accordance with announcing a Muslim Recognition Day.
Bingo.
Which was pointed out there too that we have to mention in context. Let me turn to you, Bob Cargill. How do you see this case? Because – prayers have started each day at the Iowa House, the Senate, each day for years and years.
Yeah, but they don't start every city council meeting. There are plenty of cities, including Iowa City here, that don't necessarily begin with prayers to a specific god, calling on a specific deity to grant certain things. Sure, it's a tradition. It's a tradition that goes way back. And as you mentioned, you know, so is slavery. But there comes a point when we decide, hey, yes, we've always done this, but is this right? Should we continue to do it because we've always done it? And you know, one of the litmus tests that I like to use is if we took it out, could we put it back? So the question being, right now it's like, well, we've always done this, let's keep it in there. But if the Supreme Court came down 5-4 in the other direction and we said, you know what, we can't have an elected governor pardon me, of a state opening up with a prayer to a specific deity and in the form of this proclamation, calling on Iowans, inviting them, let's say, to not only pray to a specific deity, but to engage in acts of worship, including repentance. And when you talk about repentance, is repentance to what? To the teachings of this deity. Calling on Iowans to repent to the teachings of this deity so that said deity can heal our land. Once you start doing this, if we took that out, if the Supreme Court went 5-4 the other way, do you think in 10 years when it came up again that it would go back in? And I would say no. So, you know, slavery was there. It was debated. And then when it came out, we're not going to put slavery back. And when this is overturned, and it ultimately will be overturned, that you will finally realize that the founders understood that opening up while calling on a generic deity, okay. But when you're calling on a specific deity, citing a specific, highly problematic verse in 2 Chronicles 7:14, and in doing so, this deity will then perform some function on our behalf, I think you've crossed a line and it becomes highly problematic.
Mm-hmm. Chuck Hurley, very quickly, because we want to get to a caller and I want to also get back to Dennis here. But what are your concerns? You said, you know, we need help. What are your concerns if government bodies and actions do not include references to Christianity, to prayers, overt actions like that? What are your specific fears?
That's a great question. It's not so much a fear as it is just a hard rule of history. John Adams said, quote, "It is religion and morality alone which can establish the principles upon which freedom can securely stand. The only foundation of a free constitution is pure virtue," unquote. So if we want our experiment in ordered liberty, if we want our free constitution to continue, Adams says, and frankly I think Adams is a lot smarter than I am, and probably smarter than the rest of the guests on this radio show, very bright man, he said the only hope for us to maintain our freedom is to rest it on religion and morality. And later he talks clearly about, you know, Christian morality. That, and we can dispute whether it's Unitarian, Congregationalist, Baptist, Anabaptist, blah, blah, blah. But the point was they believed in Jesus.
Okay.
And they were religious people. And so they were forcefully trying to maintain a very fragile experiment in ordered liberty. This was life and death to them. This was not an academic debate. And so to repair to the Creator, in this case explicitly, in their cases, most of their cases, explicitly the Creator in John chapter 1, Jesus, was essential for us to maintain our country. Now,
we're running out of time. I want to make sure Dennis Goldford responds to that because he's written, he's the author of The Constitution of Religious Freedom. What about those comments, Dennis Goldford? Sorry to cut you off, but we're running out of time. I want to give everybody a fair shot here.
Sure.
No. Part of the problem is I don't think it's ultimately a question that has an historical answer because you can cherry pick a quote from just about anybody to prove just about anything you want. For example, Jefferson talks in the Declaration of Independence clearly about the idea of a Creator. Jefferson also said in a letter to a friend of his that the book of Revelation is the ravings of a maniac. So which Jefferson do you want? You can cherry pick quotes. As with regard to the governor's proclamation, I think, you know, Terry Branstad, as Terry Branstad, is absolutely free and indeed can be encouraged to tell his friends and families that they ought to pray in certain circumstances. But he's not the pastor in chief of the state. He's the governor. And as such, he does not have a religious role. It is not a religious position. And so I guess I would argue, based upon my book, that it is not appropriate for him to encourage everybody in his official capacity as governor to pray. It's simply not his business.
Let's go to Don in Woodward. Thank you for waiting, Don. You've been listening to our conversation. What do you have to chip in?
Hey, thanks. And it's always great to hear Dennis Goldford. Thank you so much. I want to would like your panelists to refresh themselves on American history. Several times it's been stated that the U.S. was built on this whole notion of religious freedom. That's a real, real misunderstanding of history. In colonial times, if you were not Puritan, you could not live in Massachusetts. If you were not Catholic, you could not live in Maryland. If you were not Presbyterian, you could not live in Virginia. So Pennsylvania had an open-door policy. They'd let anybody in. But the other colonies, they were very much exclusionary. We were built on this exclusionary principle, and unfortunately it's still bleeding through 200-plus years later. So I would like folks to understand that the whole notion of plurality and perhaps religious freedom is a rather new perspective. It's not one from the founders. At the time of the founders, when they talked about religious freedom and the reaction against establishment of an official church, they were specifically talking about the Church of England. That's specifically what it was. And so in more modern times, we have expanded that to much, much broader context. Anyhow, that's my my 2 cents worth.
Don in Woodward, thank you. More than 2 cents worth, I think we got. Scott Peters, respond to that comment. So our idea when we say this country was founded on religious freedom is a new creation in thinking?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, to some extent, obviously, the country was founded on religious freedom, and the idea of religious freedom and freedom of conscience is deeply embedded in our founding narrative and in the beliefs and actions of various founders. That said, it's a much more complicated picture. As your caller noted, it's a much more complicated picture than we sometimes paint it. At the same time that that Congress ratified the First Amendment, that contained those religious protections, 8 states had some kind of test, religious test for office. Maryland, South Carolina, Georgia, Connecticut, Massachusetts all still officially supported a state church. But while that was happening, Virginia passed what was at the time probably the most tolerant protection of religion that certainly had ever happened in our country, authored by Jefferson, pushed through the Virginia legislature by Madison. So this was it sort of highlights, I think, the difficulty of looking at all the historical evidence, as our caller noted. I'll also say, though, that those disagreements and the frankly the politics of all of this still continue today, and we can see it on the Supreme Court. Chuck mentioned coercion, that a proclamation by the governor wouldn't violate the Constitution because there's no coercion here. And that is a concept that figures big in the recent Supreme Court case that he mentioned. But I would also note that the justices themselves have had a very hard time over the last 30 years or so deciding what standards should be used in cases like that. Some of the justices think the state should have to coerce people, that without coercion it doesn't violate the Establishment Clause. Other justices think if the state merely endorses religion in some way, or if a law has an effect of promoting religion, that it does violate the Establishment Clause.
So to be clear, in this recent Supreme Court case, even if the prayers at this government meeting, to start the government meeting, are overwhelmingly Christian, and the prayers are, and the citizens are encouraged to participate, that doesn't reach the standard that you were just talking about.
And in the majority opinion, the element of coercion is largely established by the facts of the case. So it was adults in the room, not kids. It was people who could understand what was going on. It was a prayer that was mostly directed toward the council members themselves, not sort of a big prayer gathering for the public kind of thing. All of that matters. All of the context really matters in deciding that.
As we get toward the end of the hour, Scott Peters, Bob Cargill, Chuck Hurley, and Dennis Goldford, I want to sort of cast our thoughts forward and have you reflect on that as well. We're running out of time, and I want to divide up time so we get to each of you before we end the hour. Bob Cargill, you wanted to jump in here with a point?
I think when we think about how the founders understood religious freedom, one thing to look at is how did they understand equality? right? So, you know, religious freedom, yeah, it sounds nice and free and open and libertarian, but it was actually very, very qualified because these same founders said that all men are created equal, but not really all men. Some men.
Women shouldn't have the vote.
Women, slaves, things like this.
Only landowners vote.
Correct. So, I mean, yeah. when we try to apply modern free thinking, you know, ideas anachronistically back on the actual, you know, the context of the situation there, religious freedom doesn't necessarily – I do not think that word means what you think it means.
Okay. Chuck Hurley, your thoughts as we close this hour?
I think that it's incumbent on governments at every level to accord the maximum freedom of conscience. The most troubling issue in this arena to me is the coercion that is clear in the heavy penalties, I think $1.3 million per day to a company who has strong religious beliefs that the IUD and that the morning after pill and so forth kill a human being. And so I think, you know, that's the biggest concern that I have.
But Hobby Lobby, the case you're remembering, is not Scott Peters, is not a religious organization. Otherwise, it would be exempted, right?
Well, listen, we all have deeply held beliefs, and corporations have been ruled recently to be people for free speech rights. And so why would we want coercion, I guess, to flip it around? Why would we want Hobby Lobby to be forced to do something that they think is murder? That and violates their religious belief.
Dennis Goldford, can you respond to that in that case?
Not in the time we have left.
Let's come back.
Chuck's a tremendously charming guy, but we need a lot more time. But I think real quickly, in the history of the Supreme Court decisions on these matters, the concept of coercion itself is highly contested, what counts as coercion and what not. I mean, if you have to sit through a prayer of somebody else's religion in order to get your high school degree, but you'd be sent it if you chose not to, are you being coerced in some way or being deprived of the right to participate in a meaningful experience? Lee versus Weissman going way back. But coercion is a troublesome concept the courts wrestled with throughout this history. But I would just also say to conclude that, at least from my perspective, I would argue, as strange as this sounds, the Constitution does not protect religion. Religion in the sense of institutions, practices, and beliefs. The Constitution does not protect religion. It protects religious freedom. And that's a very different way of understanding
that. Explain quickly the difference there.
Well, religious freedom means it's the right of you and me and each of us to make our own religious choices insofar as those are consistent with everybody else's equal right to make his or her own religious choices. But it means you can try to persuade anybody you want of the truth of your particular religious views, but what you cannot do on this view is invoke the machinery of the state to enforce those views in some way when you lose the persuasive argument.
Scott Peters, as we close here, your thoughts?
Well, in terms of invoking the machinery of the state, I think that that those are the questions that end up before the courts, right? And where the courts are asked to try to interpret these two clauses of the Constitution that we've been talking about. And I guess I would just stress that there are any number of areas where the justices themselves are divided. Often they divide on how they apply the Constitution. They at least agree on what the standard is they're supposed to use. On religion cases, they often can't even agree on what the standard is they're supposed to use.
Mm-hmm. As we look further into the future, decades ahead, as our country continues to diversify in terms of the people here, also the religions on these shores, what do we see there? Does anyone want to venture a guess there? Bob Cargill.
I think, again, going back to the principle of if you found something unconstitutional, could you put it back? If you prohibition, we banned alcohol and then we put it back. We were successful to put, you know, to once again legalize alcohol. You know, once we legalize same-sex marriage, is it ever going to be a case where we're going to go back and ban it again? No, there's not. We're moving towards this freedom, this liberty, that is not necessarily based on one conservative group's interpretation of the Bible. And I would argue the same thing for this case is going to continue to come up. And once we decide, once it is decided that you cannot offer a prayer to a specific God and then call upon the people to worship and engage in acts of worship to a specific God. Once that comes out, it won't be going back.
Okay, Dennis Goldford, we started off with you. Let's end with you. What do you see going forward, decades to come? The same sort of court cases, the same sort of gray area, just as big as it is now?
I think so. Religion matters to people. It's important. And our Constitution recognizes that religion matters to each other. The problem is, how do we live in a body politic in which people have divergent and sometimes conflicting religious beliefs and sometimes aren't content with their own persuasive powers and sometimes try to use government for a little extra help? That's the problem.
Okay. Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University, author of The Constitution of Religious Freedom, God, Politics, and the First Amendment. Scott Peters, associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Chuck Hurley, president of the Family Policy Center, former president of the Family Leader. And Bob Cargill, assistant professor of religious studies and classics at the University of Iowa. Thank you all for joining in this discussion. Thank you for all the listeners who joined our discussion about religious freedom and the separation of church and state. I want to remind you, tomorrow on this program, June 3rd, primary day, check our 2014 voter guide at iowapublicradio.org. Be sure to tune in for our day after analysis. That'll be on Wednesday with Tim Hagel and Kathy Obradovich. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.